Hey everyone, my name is Eunice.
And I'm Michelle.
And I'm Mauro.
And we're here with Native Questions, a podcast to discuss contemporary issues relevant to Indigenous youth. So today we have a question for you, and the question is, why would someone cold-heartedly kill a 16-year-old?
No one really knows for sure why anyone would do that, but it has happened more often than a lot of people think. And do you know of any specific cases where that's happened, Eunice?
I do, actually. So this particular case is the story of a mother named Pauline Mitchell, and she had a 16-year-old son. And he had gone to a rodeo in the June of 2001, so it's summertime in Colorado, and he never came home that night.
So when did they find him?
So they found him after 5 days. So if you can imagine Pauline being distraught for 5 days and worried about her son's well-being. They had found him brutally disfigured and beaten to death and left in a canyon.
And did they find out who did it?
Actually, they did. So that night at the party, Fred Martinez had actually met an 18-year-old named Sean Murphy, and they had gone to a party after the rodeo, and the details are actually unclear. But later, Sean Murphy agreed to second-degree murder and also was sentenced to 40 years in jail. And he was quoted to have said, "I beat up a fag."
That's really sad that it was taken that far. I have heard about Fred Martinez, but I didn't know that his murder was that brutal. He was a two-spirit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that means that his body simultaneously housed a masculine and a feminine spirit.
That's right.
That's what his community and he believed. And that term is specific to Native North American groups. And it usually refers to someone who's anatomically male, but that's not always.
Thanks for that definition, Michelle. So today we're going to engage with different documentaries and events and books that explore the issue of queer Indigenous sexualities, and we'll also be talking with a professor. Anyways, you had just mentioned the concept of spirit, right?
Yes.
That's really interesting just because the concept of spirit is generally not associated with gender, especially because this fluid understanding of having a masculine spirit and a feminine spirit is probably difficult to understand in a Western social context that constructs gender in a strict binary. So you're either a male or you're a female, and then society probably expects you to be strictly heterosexual. So anyone who challenges those binaries then becomes non-normative, just like Fred Martinez.
Yeah, I can only imagine how his mom felt.
Yeah, that's really observant of you, Michelle. His mom actually did have a statement during the trial, and she says, "My son Fred Martinez, as he was known by family and friends, left this world much too soon because of those who fear and hate anyone who is different."
Yeah, personally, growing up in a Western culture, thinking about gender in terms of spirit is kind of obscure to me. A lot of people in the Indigenous communities have thought about gender this way for a long time, hundreds of years, and think about gender a lot more fluidly than Western culture does. Most tribes associated certain tasks as being a man or a woman's role, but oftentimes they would cross over. So men would do tasks that were associated with a woman's role without having their sexuality questioned.
Yeah, and that's probably not the case today, because if someone partakes in an activity normally associated with the opposite sex, then their sexuality becomes automatically in question. So in the case of Fred Martinez, he was known to wear makeup around high school and bring a purse to school, so he was actually a target of bullying.
Yeah, it's really sad that two spirits like Fred Martinez face the persecution that they do today, because before colonialism, they were widely accepted in their communities and even had special roles during some ceremonies.
I feel like this is a good segue point for us to give our interviewee a call. So today we'll be talking to Dr. Chris Finley, and she is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes and co-editor and contributor to Queer Indigenous Studies, Critical Interventions in Theory, Politics, and Literature. So let's give her a call. Hello?
Oh, hello. How's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Thanks so much for being on the show with us today. We really appreciate it, and we're really glad to talk to you. So I guess we'll just start off with you telling us a little bit about your work.
So, yeah, my thing is more about, like, kind of evaluating representations of Indigenous people. And, you know, and also, like how, you know, Indigenous people, you know, take those representations and change them into something else. And also, like, how we've internalized those ideas, too. So that's kind of more of, like, the work that I do. But for my tribe, we don't have, like, a two-spirit situation. But what's interesting about that is that we have recently adopted a gay marriage into our tribe, which is really surprising to me because, you know, like, you know, most people on my reservation that I know are really, you know, pretty homophobic, you know, because that's one of the ways that colonization has really affected us in a negative way.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you were saying about the representations of Indigenous people? Like, how are Indigenous people, like, represented, and, like, what is what you see?
Obviously, most of the images we see of Indigenous people are of us, like, in the past, or, like, you know, like, especially for women in terms of, like, you know, Sacagawea and, like, Pocahontas or other, like, trader figures, you know, are like, the prominent representations of Indigenous people. Most of my students, when I ask them about, like, when they think about representations of Indigenous people, they always cite the film, the cartoon Pocahontas. The thing is, too, is that that's actually what, you know, Indigenous kids are exposed to also. And I used to love that shit, right? I was like, you know, I was so happy when there was Indians, you know, like when I heard the, you know, the drums, you know, come in and I knew that the Indians are going to come and invade the settlers. I was like, yes, you know, and I didn't see really the problem of being represented as a bloodthirsty savage, you know, but I also knew that I was never on the winning side of things too. So I feel like those things really take a toll on us as a people, because all we usually see are negative stereotypes.
What are some misconceptions that you see people having about Indigenous communities?
We exist in the modern world or whatever, right? So it's not like we get to be, you know, beyond that somehow or whatever. And that's one of the other things I think it's important to disrupt. And I don't hear you all, like, saying this or whatever, but just the idea that, you know, Indigenous people are better with sexuality and better with gender stuff because often we're not, you know, like, traditional practices can be, for sure, but I'm really interested in practices that, are actually that we're inventing for ourselves now, you know?
What are some of the effects of colonialism that you, like, see affecting different communities and the existence of, like, different practices, even, like, hindering their development?
Just like with the murdered and missing Indigenous women, you know, like the fact that we are obviously so murderable, that takes a toll on me as a person. Like, I can't, you know, because it's obvious that, like, my presence here can be eliminated and nothing is going to happen or nothing's going to change, you know. So, so those are, I think, you know, in a lot of ways we ended up, you know, dealing with that stuff is, like, through, like, you know, drug addiction and all these other problems that, you know, colonization has wrought within, you know, our lives and our families and our communities, and things that, unfortunately, we have passed on, you know, we've been passing on to the next generation.
What are the roles that, like, sexuality and gender play in colonialism and also, like, decolonization?
Oh, yeah, and once again, I think that they play very, very big roles in decolonizing because, you know, I think that there's this idea that, you know, sexuality is like, you know, this extravagant idea that we'll get to after, you know, the revolution happens, you know, after, you know, decolonization happens. And it's kind of like the same with, like, you know, gender. Like, we'll give women rights after, you know, we achieve all these goals, you know, from, you know, political struggle or whatever else is going on. And it never, and I think that's what's the really cool thing about Native feminisms is that it's very much about trying to create, like, these worlds of, you know, these decolonial worlds that we want to live in, like, now, as we struggle for political change, as we struggle for land, you know, as we struggle against the heteropatriarchy, because, you know, without like changing our relationship to, you know, the way that we actually, a lot of Indigenous people are, you know, like very much embedded in heteropatriarchy now. Even though if, you know, cause I know from my tribe, the Caldwell Confederated Tribes, we very much had a matriarchal society, you know, and, but, you know, with heteropatriarchy, like we don't get to exist outside of colonization. And, we very much have adopted to having, you know, to heteropatriarchy, and which I think has caused, you know, a lot of disruption, not only obviously for, like, you know, for women and children and the land, but also for men too, for Native men, because I think it just creates all these different ways of trying to be in the world that actually, you know, may not be natural, you know, to our ancestors, you know, and trying to live in, you know, relationship with them and their ideas. So I think it's very much a part of colonization, as I was saying before. And I also think it's completely necessary to decolonizing, to make these issues, like, you know, the center of our movements. Because, you know, like, I think we should always think about the most vulnerable people in our communities when we are, you know, organizing for change, because, you know, if we don't, then, you know, we are going to, like, leave people behind and not, you know, and then not have a society or community that I would actually really want to, you know, try to be a part of, you know.
What are practices that you see happening now that challenge, like, quote-unquote, like, traditionalism or these, like, heteronormative and, like, colonial ideas?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, as Jennifer Denadale talks about in her work, which I think is so compelling, is this idea that we are not, like, you know, as women, as radical Indigenous people, supposed to even challenge, like, traditional cultural practices, right? Because if you do that, you're already seen as a traitor, I mean, you know, to, like, your race, you know, to your people, you know, to all of these different things. When, of course, as Denadel discusses, you know, these practices actually haven't been in place for very long, you know, if you consider the whole trajectory, historical trajectory of, you know, of a people, you know, like for the last, like, 100 years, you know, for us, I feel like it's been since the Indian New Deal of, like, the 1930s, right, where these ideas started really getting perpetrated, at least in my family, because in the 1930s, it was the, you know, Great Depression, and until that point, you know, my family was able to keep their children away from the boarding school. But then when the Depression came, you know, Indigenous people really suffered and they didn't have enough food to feed, you know, to feed their children. And that's why for my family, that's when they sent them to boarding school. So they're like, well, at least we, you know, we want them to survive and to live, which is why they went to boarding school, not because they wanted them to, you know, to benefit in any other, you know, way, or they thought that, you know, Western society was superior or any of these kind of ideas. So but the other thing I think that actually is really a good challenge to traditionalism and, like, a practice of traditionalism is this idea that Indigenous communities are, like, dynamic and that we constantly change, you know, when things happen. You know, like, you know, the Native people I know, like, we use fishing poles, you know, I mean, not everybody, but a lot of people do. And I don't think that's, like, you know, not traditional. Because I'm like, hey, if you have this awesome new tool that the Jersey offers you, I don't think you have to turn it away because it's not what our ancestors used, you know. And that's what I really like about some of the artistic work I see where, you know, they show Indigenous people, like, with their iPhone or, you know, using tools of, you know, the modern age, you know, to, like, because this idea that we don't get to exist in modernity, I think, is really, you know, it's absurd. So, and it's it's also really deadly to us, obviously, too, because it's our way of erasing us and making it seem like, you know, we do only exist in the past, you know, we're not changing with the present time. But if you think about what's happened to us and the fact that we're still alive today, you know, that to me shows the tremendous strength, you know, that we have in our, like, own, like, changing, you know, our cultural traditions to match, you know, like what actually is happening to our communities. And also to think about what Charlene Teeter says, who's a Spokane Indian, she talks about this in that documentary in Whose Honor. She's the one who, you know, went to actually did change the Washington Redskins, mascot situation. And she talks, she said this really powerful thing, which I had never thought about, which is, you know, we should thank our ancestors for all we have, because there's always this idea that, you know, that Indigenous people, like, we've lost so much, which is absolutely true, but to also be really thankful for what we still have, you know, because I think that can get really lost in, you know, feeling, you know, just being overwhelmed by all the loss that we have actually had to experience and have to experience every day just walking around in, you know, a settler colony. So I think it's always about art. I think that's where a lot of the change begins to happen. As I was saying before, that, you know, the fact that my tribe has passed a gay marriage act, which, you know, is not my favorite, you know, part of the queer, you know, rights movement or whatever, but I actually think that, you know, within Indigenous communities like mine, I think that that is actually a positive, like, first step, because, you know, trying to include queer people who want to marry, like, into the community in a very, you know, legitimate way, is, I think, actually an important step to make, you know, so.
Why did you start doing the work that you do? Why did you decide to become a professor? Why are you, like, drawn to the work that you, like, participate in? Because it's very, like, valuable work.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, I really feel like it's something that actually called to me. You know, like, I think I actually tried to avoid it for a long time, to be honest with you. Because, you know, it's really scary. It's not the popular thing that, you know, people want, you know, Indigenous people always want to talk about or whatever, even though there's this perception that Indigenous people are, like, super awesome on queer issues, which, you know, and gender issues, which I wish was, you know, completely true or whatever, but it's not always true, right? Because we have work to do, too. So, yeah, I really felt like it was the work, you know, or my ancestors, I don't know, that called me to do the work that I did, that I started doing. It really was, like, in my third year, I think, of graduate school. And I went to the Native American and Indigenous Studies Conference in Athens, Georgia. And I got to be on this panel with actually the other co-editors of the Queer Indigenous Studies Collection. And, you know, I finally had found, like, you know, in that moment, I found, like, my intellectual home, you know, and it was one that we actually began to create together. And that had been in the works, you know, there had been other Indigenous people like Paula Gunn Allen and other people who had begun this work, you know, before. So it just really felt like it was, like, the right, like, place, and it was, like, the right moment for that to actually really spring, you know, into something, you know, like, beautiful and something that would actually, you know, create this foundation for the anthology to happen, you know. And so I think that that's how I came to do this work that I do. And because honestly, I was going to drop out of graduate school because it just seems like a whole lot of bullshit to me. So, and I was like, so, and I think that that's what's really important is that, you know, you don't always find, you know, your intellectual community at your institution that you're at, you know, that you might find it, you know, cobbling together other people from other places who are thinking similar things that you are, you know, makes you know that you're not completely just crazy or, you know, shooting in the dark, and that this work is important and valuable. And I mean, I guess really, so what I'm trying to say in a very poor way is that it really came from my own positionality as a queer Indigenous person, you know, and not feeling that there was a lot of work out there that really spoke to me and, like, the things that I thought, you know, I think are important about, you know, decolonizing and these kind of, you know, more positive projects. So
I guess it's these conversations don't happen that often.
And why is
and
that?
And I feel like that, yeah, why is it that it is that way? The question that I've been, like, thinking a lot about was I'm going to try and phrase it as a question, but it's, like, been a lot of assortment of jumbled thoughts in my mind. The concept or, like, the notion of queerness, like, as it, like, in Western, like, context, like, the creation of, like, queerness as like a Western like concept, how it is it like is it like problematic to label these to put on these like Western constructions into like onto other groups such as like Indigenous people? I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does make sense. And that's a really complicated question. And I think that in a way, I think it really has to, I think it depends on the people that you're talking about. But obviously that's very much the basis of my argument, is talking about how, you know, Indigenous people are queered and seen as killable in terms of biopolitics, because we don't, you know, we don't maintain this heterosexual like norms, right? That's one of the ways that makes us like a threat to the nation state. I think that, for me, I guess I'm only at this place in my work where I'm just like so sick of settlers and talking about settlers and their shenanigans that, cause, you know, obviously, you know, for me, I mean, not every Indigenous person, you know, all around the world lives in like, you know, a Western, developed Western nation, you know, with all the problematics that go along with that. So for me, like, you know, I identify as queer, and which also, you know, is a very political, you know, term to use, right? And I really like it because it's like it's a big umbrella term. You know, like that to me, like gets to like, you know, gender queer stuff, you know, how like the different types of queer people, like, you know, the bisexuals, you know, whatever, you know. It's a huge term, and that's one of the things that I really appreciate about it. But the thing is like there are definitely Indigenous people who only identify as Two-Spirit. And and for me, like, I am really respectful of like how people want to identify. And what's really, I think, critical about that is that the fact that they've thought it out, you know, they know why they identify as Two-Spirit, you know, or as, you know, or if they, you know, identify as queer. So I think that that's kind of one of the ways I would go about thinking about that, because, obviously, queer studies is dominated by white people and whiteness, and settler colonialism that mostly goes, you know, uninterrogated. But for me, I'm not in denial about any of that, but I just don't want to think about how that defines me and my work anymore. And, you know, and maybe I can't just make that refusal, but I'm going to try, and I do. So I'll let you know how that works out for me, personally, you know. Because, you know, I've definitely had people come up to me. And what's interesting about that, too, is it's very much a generational thing, right? Queer people of a certain age, like the word queer just sets them on in, because that was a slur that was used against them, right, which is why we've, you know, why we've taken it back. But and I'm also trying to be respectful of that too, right? I think, like, you know, the word, you know, the term queer and queerness, I think that, you know, all these terms, as like Fred Moten and Stefano Harney talk about, are just, you know, they are theoretical terms. And for me, I hope that they're like a beginning of a conversation, right? Because as they talk about, theory should be social, right? And should talk, you know, should, you know, be a beginning of the conversation with people, and not used to like shut down the conversation with people, hopefully, you know? But you know, it's kind of like what I think you're, you know, talking about, is that it actually could shut down, you know, conversations, if people don't want to, you know, be referred to, in that way. So, I think that one of the big problems is kind of like what we're talking about in relation to, you know, studying and learning in the, you know, academic industrial complex, is people don't always take the time to have those difficult conversations, you know, or even ask people like how they identify, because I think that is, you know, really important information, and that we should be very respectful, you know, to those things. Yeah, but they take time.
Yeah, definitely. So I've been thinking a lot about that. I personally also identify as queer, and like in the other class that I'm taking with Dr. Wayne, Ethnic Images in Film, we watched a film this week that was about, like, I think it might be like a recent film or something, but I'm not very good with movies, but I took the class because Wayne was teaching it.
Smart move.
It was about, and the movie, I think it was called, like, it was about an Iranian, like, bisexual woman.
Oh, is it appropriate behavior?
Yeah. Have you watched the film?
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm planning on teaching it because Wayne was talking about it. And I was like, oh, you know, if Wayne liked this film, it must be good. So I'm gonna watch it before I, you know, completely put it on my syllabus, but I was totally going to do that. So anyways, I want to hear what you think about the film.
The film made me think a lot. I also don't want to spoil the film for you.
okay, correct. So we might have to talk about this later.
Yeah, because essentially, like, how the film, like, starts off is just, like, the Iranian woman was in a relationship with a white woman, and they broke up. For, like, example, one of the problems that they had was just the white woman was trying to make, was, seems like, constantly pressuring the Iranian woman to, like, come out to, like, her family.
Yeah.
And this interesting, like, thing that I kept noticing was just, like, this was, like, stressed so much. But in, like, in the Iranian woman's family, they don't really talk about that. And it's just, like, it's different in terms of, like, their culture and, like, the way that she interacts with her family and everything. And she's, like, they know, but we just, like, haven't really ever explicitly stated it. I felt like there were these notions of, like, these homonormative notions that were trying to be, like, imposed on, like, her.
Yeah.
Like, almost this idea that, like, coming out is going to bring this, like, transformative, like, experience that, like, you'll be completely, like, liberated after you do this. Or something. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, like, you have to go through this process of, like, possibly suffering and humiliation to be able to fly the rainbow flag, right? But, you know, for me, it's just, like, you just go through that thing. I think that, you know, white people just really love to confess, right? I think that we should love to confess, too. So that's what I mean, obviously, I'm making a joke, but I find that, you know, this idea, because, you know, that's, again, one of those ways that, you know, I think, you know, whiteness, like, dominates, like, queerness in a way, you know, or, like how, you know, it should look, how your narrative of progress should look as a queer citizen or whatever, you know, so, which I find very problematic, and that they don't understand how different it is in different communities of color, you know, like, what these things mean, and also, like, how we do come out to our families, you know. I think it is very different, and it doesn't have to be, like, this explicit statement or this party or, you know, whatever else, you know, people think it has to do, so, yeah, in order to be, like, legitimate, right, or whatever.
Yeah, the film definitely made me think. There's some parts that I was just like, I'm not really feeling it, but it made me think about these things because I've been thinking about them, like, for a while. So that I liked about the film, and there were also some parts of the film that were, like, kind of funny.
Or it actually, what it sounds like to me is that it actually is, like, you know, that film offered, you know, like, it made you want to, like, you know, it offered this idea of social, you know, being social again, you know, like, thinking and wanting to talk about it or, you know, like, trying to work something out in your mind. And I think, again, like, this is one of the places, you know, where art you know, really can do things that it's harder to do, like, you know, in academic writing, you know. It can be more absurd and funny and interesting than we get to be. But yeah, I mean, to me, like, the fact that you actually think about it afterwards, I think is very, I think that's a really good sign that, like, it haunts you, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. I've just been thinking of that and, like, trying, making sense of, like, all of these, like different things. Like, queerness isn't, there is no, like, one way to be, like, queer, I think.
Right.
Like, there's this homogenized, like, very, like, white-dominated way of, like, this is, like, queerness, and that's something that I'm just like, no.
And lastly, Dr. Chris Finley, I'd want to ask you, since our target audience is Native youth, I wanted to ask you if you had any, like, closing remarks or anything that, or any, like, last thoughts that you would want to, like, directly give to that audience.
Well, I always think of, I think of Fred Moten's work, because this is, like, the thing I always tell my students is the only thing I want you to learn, and this is from any class I teach, is about there's nothing wrong with you. Like, you don't need to be corrected. You know, like, that very idea. And I think, you know, being, like, I know when I was young and, you know, there was always this idea that there was something very wrong with how I looked, who I was, you know, because, like, you're this Native person and you're not supposed to actually exist, right? But then you do. Mm-hmm. And there's something really abnormal about that. And so I think that would be, like, my main message that I would like to say.
That was pretty much, like, everything I, like, had as, like, questions and whatnot. I really want to thank you for your time.
No, it was so great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and have a good afternoon or evening, whatever you want to call it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Back to you, Eunice and Michelle.
That brings us to the topic of colonialism. And actually, the United States has a long, violent history of settler colonialism on indigenous lands. And I actually recently took a class that touched briefly on Native American boarding schools, and it talked about how just the horrifying ways that the school functioned to effectively enact cultural genocide by killing the Indian and saving the man. So actually there are a lot of cases of sexual, physical, emotional, and mental abuse that the young Natives had to endure. And in summary, this was kind of a conglomeration of the efforts of missionaries and government agencies and boarding schools and white settlers. And all in all, it caused the loss of many traditions in Native communities.
And one of those experiences being Two-Spirit roles, because the term Two-Spirit is relatively new, and it's kind of an umbrella term used to describe Native third genders. And there are actually 150 documented tribes that have some sort of variation of two-spirit gender. And the term came about in the early 1990s as an alternative to Western labels like homosexual, gay, and transsexual. But there are so many different terms to describe third and even fourth genders, such as the Navajo Nadle.
Hey, Michelle, have you heard of that book called Drowning in Fire by Craig Womack?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read the whole thing. I heard it's a really good specific account of a young Native man trying to understand his sexuality and struggling within the context of his culture.
Right, so Drowning in Fire is actually a story about a young man named Josh, and he grew up in an indigenous community, also influenced by the Christian tradition, so he was grown up being taught that homosexuality was wrong, but he wrestled with his attraction to other boys as a child. And it's a deeply personal account where he hears stories from his great aunt growing up, and it's really beautifully written, so I can imagine how it can be a powerful way for Native youth to connect to this story and people who are going through similar things.
Yeah, it sounds like Josh from Drowning in Fire and Fred Martinez are really important examples of challenges that a lot of people face today in relation to sexuality within Native communities. And I think colonialism has presented a lot of new challenges for those in Native communities who don't fit into the strict binary gender categories that Western society has constructed.
So far, we've been discussing the Two-Spirit concept in Indigenous communities, but I think it's important to emphasize that having multiple or nuanced gender identities is not unique to Indigenous communities, and it's actually been documented globally throughout the world. So, you know how you mentioned how each Indigenous community will have different understandings of the third gender role?
Yeah.
I think if we expand that to the global scope, third gender roles become even more varied. So I'm thinking about how the society probably has stereotypical expectations placed upon third gender people, and I'm wondering if you know any specific examples, Michelle, of what it's like to kind of constantly swim against the current.
I do. I actually know about a transgendered community in Indonesia called the Waria, and they get that term from the words Wanita, which means woman, and Priya, which means man. And they're typically in their community seen as sex workers on the side of the road at night and wearing miniskirts, often as drag queens and on TV.
Is that how they view themselves, though?
Actually, the Waria community is very diverse. It includes men who identify very closely as women, so much so that they embody that every day, and others who only dress up on occasion and wear makeup sometimes, but they're actually very diverse. And one Waria that I read about actually quoted how they feel about themselves by saying, "In the end, only a Waria knows what it means to be a Waria. We have to define ourselves." And there's actually a documentary about
called them, Tales of the Waria,
which talks about three individuals who identify as Waria and their search for romantic relationships and the struggles that they face in their community, how they have to leave their lovers often because society expects them to marry women and have children.
Wow, that must be really painful.
Yeah, definitely. Do you know of any other communities that face similar struggles, Eunice?
Yeah, actually that reminds me of a documentary called Kumuhina, and it's about the struggles of a Native Hawaiian woman named Kumuhina, and she is identified as a mahu, or a transgender woman, and actually her role in society is very celebrated and honored and respected. She's a kumu, or a teacher, and she teaches students and youth hula dancing, and also, as she does so, also teaches them cultural practices and traditions and values. So throughout the course of the documentary, she tells us about how, unlike a lot of other transgender people, she's really fortunate to have found love in a committed relationship with a man.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how third genders are celebrated differently in different parts of the world. For example, the Muxas in Oaxaca, Mexico, they're part of the Zapotec indigenous community, and there they're accepted, and it's understood that there are men, women, and Muxas in that area. So the Muxas are born men, raised as women, and then they live their whole life as women.
Yeah, and just to add off of that note about how celebrated they are, there's actually a celebration in November called the Vigil of the Authentic Intrepid Searchers of Danger. It takes place in the city of Juchitán, Oaxaca in Mexico, and it basically is an all-day festivity event to celebrate the ways that the Muxas are a part of the community. And they're largely known to be entertainers and performers and people who are really engaging and celebrated members of society. So the festival is a 3-day event, and it consists of dancing and drinking and performances, and it's all in celebration for the Muxas in the community, who are not only a source of celebration, but also a source of pride, especially because they've had this tradition of celebration for around 3,000 years. And the climax of the night is Saturday night, when they come together and everyone dresses in ball gowns to dance away the night. And so it's a really fun festivity.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Unfortunately, a lot of the groups that we've discussed today are not as celebrated as the Muxas in Oaxaca. Most of them face stereotyping, discrimination, violence, abuse, and even hatred.
Yeah, and if we just think about the first story that we talked about with Fred Martinez and how his murder left his family in shambles, and or about if we think about the Waria folks who desire to be in romantic relationships but are left abandoned because of their position in society as anatomically male, it's just really painful to think about the spectrum of human experience.
And there's definitely a lot of pain involved in the lives of those that are affected by violence.
I agree, but I think there's also a certain sense of somber hope and beauty in the way that Fred Martinez's life and death pretty much served as a painful catalyst for nationwide awareness of the issue of violence against queer Indigenous folks. So we hope by talking about this subject that we can help usher you into a position of celebration with queer Indigenous folks and also a greater desire to foster personal allyship.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Native Questions podcast with
Eunice,
Michelle,
and Morrow.
And special guest appearance by Dr. Chris Finley. You can find more podcasts like this on www.nativequestions.com.